You're listening to The Sickle and the Hammer, a socialist history of the Soviet Union. Episode 17, Lessons to be Learned. Здравствуйте, товарищи. Hello, comrades, and welcome back. And welcome to the final focused discussion on the Russian Revolution. It has taken a while to get here, but we are finally armed with everything we need to know in order to wrestle with the really essential questions of the revolutionary period. There is no need for any sort of introduction this time around. We have several questions I think are important to grapple with so that, through exploration of them, we can glean important insights about history, historical and dialectical materialism, and hopefully come to an understanding of why some consider the Russian Revolution to be the greatest event in human history. To start, throughout 1917, we saw time and again how the Mensheviks and SRs were loath to actually exercise any power. They not only refused to take power when offered it, both when an angry mob demanded they take it in July and when offered a coalition with the Bolsheviks in a post-October dictatorship of the proletariat. But even when they entered into coalition with the cadets and the government, the best that can be said about them is they were a loyal opposition. The rationale they used was that, quote, according to Marx, the rule of the bourgeoisie had to come before the rule of the proletariat, and so it would be historically irresponsible for the workers and peasants to cut in line, as it were. So the first question is, were the Mensheviks and SRs correct in arguing that the rule of the bourgeoisie is a historical stage that cannot be skipped over? Were the Bolsheviks in violation of Marx's teachings? As we know, Papa Karl was unfortunately long dead by the time the revolution came about. So any assertions that he would have been for or against the Bolsheviks one way or the other are ultimately hearsay. Worse than that, if anyone tries to argue that Marx definitely would have agreed or disagreed on one question or another, they are likely committing the logical fallacy of appeal to authority, by which someone appeals to the supposed expert authority of someone to support their argument without considering A, if the person is actually an expert, and B, maybe the expert is still wrong because people are sometimes mistaken even in their expert opinions. So in discussing this, we are not going to claim one way or the other what Marx would have believed or said about the revolution and the Bolsheviks. But, just for kicks and giggles, why don't we see what Marx actually had to say about Russian economic development and the possibility of whether Russia could skip the rule of the bourgeoisie altogether? In the 1882 preface to the Russian edition of the Communist Manifesto, Marx updated his and Engels' analysis from 1848, when the manifesto was originally published, by accounting for the role of the development of capitalism in Russia in the interim. In 1848 and 49, Russia, ruled at the time by Tsar Nikolai I, our Nikolai's great-grandfather, had served as the reactionary backstop of Europe, lending vital support to the conservatives across the continent as they defeated the revolutionary movements that had erupted from France to Hungary. But by the 1880s, as we know, capitalism was popping off across Russia. Still small, but developing rapidly and churning out human suffering in its wake. By 1882, Marx had started to come around to the idea of the possibility of a socialist revolution starting in Russia, and had this to say, quote, the Communist Manifesto had, as its object, the proclamation of the inevitable impending dissolution of modern bourgeois property. But in Russia, we find, face to face with the rapidly flowering capitalist swindle and bourgeois property just beginning to develop, more than half the land owned in common by the peasants. Now the question is, can the Russian obshchina, though greatly undermined, yet a form of primeval common ownership of land, pass directly to the higher form of communist common ownership? Or, on the contrary, must it first pass through the same process of dissolution such as constitutes the historical evolution of the West? The only answer to that possible today is this. If the Russian Revolution becomes the signal for a proletarian revolution in the West, so that both complement each other, the present Russian common ownership of land may serve as the starting point for a communist development. End quote. Marx recognized that Russia had a uniquely vibrant culture of collectivism, rooted in the Russian obshchina, or peasant commune. And, after observing how capitalism was developing in that country, he was beginning to come around to the idea of revolution in Russia being the first domino in a series of proletarian revolutions that would sweep through Europe. Even without appealing to Marx as an authority, this excerpt is still relevant to consider because we see Marx himself applying his own dialectical materialist analysis in real time. In 1850, Marx would have thought it crazy to believe a revolution in Russia could be the first in a series that would overthrow the bourgeoisie, because of its role in crushing the liberal revolutions across Europe. By 1882, he is openly writing about this very possibility. Why? Because the material situation in Russia and Europe had changed in the intervening 30 years. And that's the point. Marxism and dialectical materialism are not dogmas. They do not put forth a set of inviolable rules. They are not a religion whose doctrine cannot be violated without incurring the wrath of history. No, Marxism as an intellectual tradition and dialectical materialism as an analytical lens are scientific methods. They rely on observation of the various phenomena that make up human existence, both in the past and the present, in order to explain what has happened and what is happening, and predict loosely the trajectory of the future. But, like any scientific method, as more information comes to light, theories and predictions are developed, tweaked, updated, or even discarded altogether. And this reveals to us the vital error that the Mensheviks and SRs made in their assessment of the situation in 1917. Marx updated his understanding of the revolutionary potential in Russia toward the end of his life. Lenin adapted his calculations for the trajectory of the revolution when the Soviets spontaneously reappeared in 1917. But the Mensheviks and the SRs did not do any of this. They instead stuck to a rigid, dogmatic, stagist interpretation of historical materialism, and therefore, as the situation morphed throughout the year, yet they stood stubbornly in one place, they ultimately were left behind. In other words, they were obsessed with the letter of historical materialism and its stages of societal development, while completely ignoring the spirit of dialectical materialism and its emphasis on concrete analysis rooted in objective observation. The Mensheviks and SRs thought they had their answer, supposedly given to them by Marx, and they simply refused to engage in any real analysis, or even to entertain any other outcome. But this leaves us with another question. Why, when the Bolsheviks were flexible and able to adapt to the evolving situation, were the Mensheviks and SRs so rigid and intransigent in their thinking? I think the answer to this second question is rooted in the origins of these parties. Remember that the Russian Social Democratic Labor Party eventually split into the Mensheviks and Bolsheviks over the question of membership. Lenin wanted to insist on active membership as a way to weld the party into a hard fist with which to strike against the bourgeoisie when the time came. The Mensheviks were content with allowing anyone who wished to call themselves a member of the party, regardless of how active they might be. The Bolshevik approach yielded a constant, direct connection with the working class through active participation. The Menshevik approach opened the door to opportunistic individuals who would try to take advantage of the party to their own ends in various ways, thereby diluting their connection to the working class. By 1917, the Mensheviks were led by more intellectually oriented socialists who had grown divorced from the masses. The Menshevik leaders knew their theory inside and out, but having lost contact with the masses, their ability to adapt that theory through analysis and to put it into practice had atrophied. As for the socialist revolutionaries, they faced their own problems in developing revolutionary theory and putting it into practice. When it came to Marx, recall from episode 3 that they more or less conceded the general correctness of Marx's work on political economy, and yet rejected his focus on the proletariat and industrial production in favor of the peasantry and agricultural production. This was rather like reviewing the blueprints for a car, agreeing that the engineering behind it is sound, but then insisting that the vehicle be fueled by salt water instead of gasoline. But they were not only starting from a contradictory understanding of historical materialism. Remember also that their roots were in the older revolutionary movements of the 1870s, the Narodniki, or populists. Except their forebears had never developed any organizational capacity to speak of. They had landed on what they believed were the correct ideas of how to enact a revolution. Basically, lots of speeches to spontaneously inspire revolution. And had tried to force their answers onto the situation. When that did not work, instead of analyzing why and refining their own theory, they had resorted to blunt political terrorism. So the SR party that emerged at the end of the 1890s was never a party of the peasant masses. Like the Mensheviks, it attracted primarily intellectuals obsessed with their own abstract ideas. Now, I want to be clear. The flaw I am identifying here in each of these parties is not intellectualism. Lenin was the most intellectual revolutionary out of all of them, and his contribution to the success of the Soviet Revolution cannot be denied. The flaw here is the failure to combine the theories that were developed with the material realities of the situation, and to update their theories as the material realities changed. Lenin and the Bolsheviks succeeded at this, where the Mensheviks and SRs failed. And for that, the former won the day, and the latter lost. But hold on, because it turns out there is a fairly straightforward punchline to all this. As the year 1917 went on, and the flaws in the Menshevik and SR parties became more and more manifest, and impacted them more and more severely, the working class abandoned the Mensheviks for the Bolsheviks, and the poor and working peasants coalesced into the left SR wing, eventually breaking with the right SRs altogether. This, in turn, meant the only ones left in the Menshevik and SR parties were, for the most part, the petty bourgeoisie, the petty aristocrats, the petty landowners, and the petty bureaucrats. So, yeah, of course they're going to insist that Marx's theory of historical progression must be observed, and that the Bolsheviks have no right to leapfrog over the stage of bourgeois dictatorship, because, in the end, it was supposed to be the stage of their dictatorship. They allied themselves with Kerensky and the cadets, and eschewed real mass power, because mass power was not in the material interests of the leaders of these parties. As Marx wrote, quote, "It is not the consciousness of men that determines their being, but, on the contrary, their social being that determines their consciousness," end quote. In other words, ideology is downstream from material reality. Asking a petty bourgeois or petty landlord to serve as the representative of the political power of the proletariat and peasantry is simply never going to work out. The next question we will consider is the one of hypotheticals. There are an infinite number of what-ifs when it comes to the revolution, so for our purposes, exploring only two will suffice. The first is about the causes of the revolution. There are quite a few number of those as well, but almost always, somewhere near the top of that list is Russian involvement in World War I, so let us look at that particular one more closely. Very often, Russia's fighting in the war is presented as a fatal mistake, a decision that doomed Nikolai. In fact, I have even come across the argument that, were it not for World War I, Russia would have continued to develop along the same path as Western Europe, eventually evolving peacefully into a parliamentary democracy of some sort or another. Under such a political arrangement, so the story goes, the Russian bourgeoisie would have developed the country in a better, more stable fashion than the Soviets did, and all the horrible political repressions could have been avoided. If it hadn't been for that damn war, none of this would have happened. Again, we know now that in reality, Nikolai's decision to join the war and the provisional government's decision to continue it were shaped by specific material conditions, which aligned the interests of first the imperial and then the bourgeois governments with the continuation of the war. But still, is it true that World War I doomed the Russian Empire? Could the Russian Revolution have happened without World War I? Put another way, could the coming to power of the Soviets and the vanguard party of the working class have been avoided if the war had been fought better, or not fought at all? First of all, we have to deal with the implications of the argument that, had it not been for the war, so-called peaceful development of capitalism in Russia would have been continued, and would have been preferable to what happened under the Soviets. If you are listening to this show, chances are you are well aware of how horrifically violent capitalist development has been historically. If you are not aware, recall in episode 4 when we talked very briefly about the inhumane conditions faced by the nascent Russian proletariat in the late 19th century. And then, imagine that tenfold in Britain, Germany, France, and the United States of the 18th and 19th centuries, and in subcontinental Asia and almost the entirety of Africa for centuries up to the present day. Then, add on slavery, genocides across multiple continents, and invasions and wars. In other words, we should immediately be incredulous of the claim that the bourgeoisie could have managed the industrial development of Russia more peacefully than the Soviets did. We are not even going to get into all the ways capitalism inflicts violence on people around the world that makes whatever violence the Soviet population experienced seem like mean-spirited fraternity hazing. But okay, even ignoring all that, let us take the premise of this question at face value. Well, as I have said several times in this series thus far, entertaining counterfactuals is always dicey business, since ultimately there is no way to know. So we ought not waste too much time and energy trying to find an answer that is not there. Still, what if there had been no war? Right off the bat, we can say a lot would have been different. No war means the Tsarist system is not pushed to the breaking point for almost 3 years, and Nikolai does not become personally so despised due to his poor handling of the war effort. So, we can suppose Tsar Nikolai would not have been overthrown in February 1917. Or, let us suppose Russia did fight in the war, but after the Tsar is forced to abdicate, the provisional government recognizes the folly of continuing to fight. And the Milyukov note, instead of being a promise of a continued war, informs Britain and France of Russia's intention to conclude a separate peace with Germany before the end of the summer campaign. If this had happened, would the soldiers in the Petro-Soviet and at the front have even paid attention to the Bolsheviks? If the soldiers were being demobilized from the fronts, they might have been available, and had the stomach for, putting down the peasant revolts that were roiling the vast countryside. Had the provisional government withdrawn from the war in the spring or summer of 1917, the revolutionary movement, and the Bolsheviks in particular, would have been deprived of one of their most effective propaganda issues. It is certainly possible that without the rallying cry of "down with the war," the Bolsheviks would have had a much harder time mobilizing the armed forces to their side. So, sure, without the war, it is possible that the revolution would not have occurred, or not in the way that it did. But I think the vastly more interesting and important query is to explore how and why things may actually still have turned out the way they did, even if the timing and circumstances would have been different. Because the war was unmistakably a catalyst for the revolutionary movement in Russia. But a catalyst only works in the proper mix of chemicals and the necessary quantities, ready for a reaction. It cannot alone create the reaction. For example, consider the following. Well before the war, the proletariat in Russia was one of the most combative in all of Europe at the time. Well before the war, the countryside was a powder keg waiting to be ignited as the half measures of the emancipation of 1861 had been falling short for decades, and new reforms were desperately needed. Well before the war, the nationalities of the Russian Empire were intent on gaining their autonomy from the Tsars. And well before the war, Nikolai was a weak and ineffective leader who was not particularly liked or respected by his peers, his subordinates, or his subjects, but who was tolerated so long as his weaknesses and ineffectiveness did not create problems for the empire. The war did not itself entirely destabilize the Russian Empire. It exacerbated the instability already present. And the fact that so much instability existed prior to 1914 is due to the contradictions inherent in Russian society at the time. The Russian Empire was an underdeveloped agrarian society still operating largely as it had two centuries prior. It was in desperate need of modernization, of industrialization, and the Tsar, both Nikolai as a leader and the Tsar as a political institution, was ill-equipped to guide the nation through this process. In the meanwhile, capitalist development was proceeding, but all the while producing its own gravediggers. We can now consider the second hypothetical, the absence of Vladimir Lenin in the revolution. For very obvious reasons, Lenin is the main focus in almost any telling of the Russian Revolution and the founding of the Soviet Union. I would say he has been, for the most part, the main character in this show thus far, as much as a show like this can have a main character. But what would have happened if Lenin had never made it back to Russia? Or if he had been arrested and executed after the July days? Or arrested the night of the 24th of October on his way to Smolny? Or what if he had never been born? This question is, to my mind at least, much more complicated than considering if the war had not been a factor in the revolution. Lenin is one half of the revolutionary ideology of Marxism-Leninism. His works, from What is to be Done and The State and Revolution, to the hundreds of articles and letters and decrees and treaties and theses written in 1917 and after, had some of the most profound impact on Russian and human history that any writing has ever had, even if most people today do not know it. Even as a Marxist-Leninist, as a dialectical materialist, I have to admit, it is harder for me to imagine the revolution succeeding without Lenin than it is without the war, or Kerensky, or Kornilov, or any other factor. That is, although I can easily picture the Russian Empire imploding in the early 20th century even without World War I, it is almost impossible for me to conceive of the Soviet Union coming about without Lenin in at least some role or capacity. And yet, in the end, I do have to reject this kind of great man conception of history. The great man theory of history, in case you are not familiar, holds that there are some figures, and almost all of them are men, hence the great man theory, because, hey, 5,000 years of patriarchy. So there are some figures that are so singularly important, so monumentally significant to the course of history, that they act as hinge points upon which history swings one direction or another. Spiritual leaders like Jesus Christ or the Prophet Muhammad. Military leaders like Napoleon Bonaparte or Adolf Hitler. Or political leaders like Vladimir Lenin, Joseph Stalin, or Mao Zedong, upon whom we are always told history swung into darkness. The problem with great man theory is it tends to obfuscate or ignore completely the systemic limitations imposed on all human beings at all times. I know I keep coming back to this quote, but it is a great one and probably one of my favorite from Marx. Quote, "Men make their own history, but they do not make it just as they please. They do not make it under circumstances chosen by themselves, but under circumstances directly encountered, given, and transmitted from the past." End quote. Even if Lenin had not made it back to Russia in 1917, the contradictions that were playing out that year would have remained. Yes, they might have been resolved in favor of the bourgeoisie instead of the proletariat and peasantry, but then again, they might not have been. For all his personal contributions to the revolution, as crazy as it may sound, Lenin and Leninism was equal parts a product of the contradictions of Russian society in the late 19th and early 20th centuries, a reflection of the revolutionary potential of the masses, and the result of the brilliance of one man. Take Lenin's origin story from episode 2. Lenin was far from the only child of a mid-level bureaucrat in the Tsarist Empire who suffered personal loss at the hands of the reaction in the 1880s and 90s. If it had not been Vladimir Lenin, the dialectics of this period would almost certainly have produced someone else capable of perceiving and theorizing like him, just as it also produced Stalin and Kamenev and Kollontai and Krupskaya. Yes, that other hypothetical person would have brought other qualities to bear in a revolution, but the point is, Lenin and Leninism were not created in a vacuum, and the forces that shaped Lenin and his thought would likely have produced someone else who could make similar contributions to the revolution. Or, we can take the April Theses, for example. In that first week of April, Lenin was literally the only leader in the Bolshevik Party, the only leader of any political party or movement across all of Russia that was calling for the revolution to proceed in the direction of a dictatorship of the proletariat. All the other prominent political leaders and activists at the time thought he was nuts. But the masses, the rank and file of the Bolshevik Party, immediately latched on to the idea. They did this not because Lenin planted the idea in their head and tricked them into helping him pursue his own path to personal power. It is because humans are, for the most part, rational creatures, extremely intelligent, and capable of intuiting what their own interests are. The April Theses did not perform Christopher Nolan-style inception on the masses of Russia and the working class. They gave clear articulation to their already present needs and interests, and once the masses had that articulation, they rallied to it. We could go through the catalog of the events of the revolution and analyze Lenin's role in each of them, but we will not, because I hope my point is clear. In the end, Lenin was just one person. Kamenev and Stalin and Kollontai were still respected and experienced leaders of the Bolsheviks. The masses were still self-aware and class-conscious. Undeniably, Lenin guided the party and the masses to victory in the revolution. But that was only possible thanks to the myriad of other factors and contradictions that were playing out at the time. Lenin did not bend the situation to his will. Instead, he understood the organic and contradictory nature of the revolution and played his role in the course of events to perfection. If we imagine there had been no war, it is not impossible that, in 1920, the peasant movement would have been the trigger for revolutionary upheaval, as the disruption in the countryside affected the production of the cities, and, in particular, the ability of the young proletariat to feed and clothe itself. If we imagine there had been no war, it is not impossible that in 1925, the bourgeoisie, fettered by the control over market forces exerted by the Tsar and his bureaucracy, would eventually have burst asunder and either swept the Tsar aside entirely, as had happened to the monarchy in France, or reduced the Russian monarch to a figurehead role with little actual power, as was the case with the British monarchy. Or, without a war, it is not impossible that, in 1917, the working people of the Russian Empire could have risen up and successfully challenged Tsar Nikolai, then joined forces with their disgruntled peasant allies and, led by the militant Bolshevik Party, challenged the aristocracy and nascent bourgeoisie. If we imagine Lenin had not been around in 1917 for whatever reason, it is not impossible that one of the other Bolshevik leaders, or even a new leader who exists only in that alternative timeline, would have emerged and led the Russian masses to victory, because the dynamics that Lenin was interacting with were still present, and the contradictions still needed to be resolved. So here is what I really want to say about the idea of hypotheticals in general. These two, and any others, people may ask about the revolution, or any other period of history for that matter. In the end, the question, could historical event X have happened if condition Y had been different, is in fact a terribly misleading question, because it reduces the entirety of the story of humanity to something akin to an equation. And this mindset does an enormous disservice to all of us. Of course, history unfolds as specific events and decisions and personalities play out. But such a question obscures what I think is the reality of history. that history is not a deterministic chain reaction stretching back into eternity, nor is it the result of iron-willed individuals inflicting themselves on the rest of us. It is, instead, a cauldron of swirling dynamics giving rise to endless contradictions, with some of them resolving themselves, only to give rise to new contradictions, and others eventually boiling over altogether. If we want to understand history, we should strive to understand the underlying causes, and the causes of those causes, and the material realities at play, even if they are obfuscated from immediate view. When we do that, whatever analysis and conclusions we draw are all the more robust for it, and using history as our guide becomes a weapon all the more powerful. If you are enjoying this show and you are in a position to do so, please consider supporting me at patreon.com/sovietpod. I have some good news and bad news. The good news is, I'm happy to say the Patreon page is fully functional now. All my current episodes have been posted there, there are different tiers with different bonuses, and we are forming a nice little community. The bad news is, you are listening to this episode late. All new episodes come out immediately on Patreon first, but then 10 days later on the RSS feed. Early access on Patreon starts at just $5 a month, so if you don't want to wait, head on over and sign up. Also, please leave a rating and review on whatever podcast services you are using, and please share the show with anyone you think might be interested. The more we get the word out, the more our community grows. Now, back to the show. This leaves us with one final question to consider in this retrospective and summation of the Russian Revolution. Why does any of this matter? What practical lessons can we learn from this period for our own struggle against capitalism and for a better world? In answering this question, I'm going to ask you all to indulge me as I glaze the hell out of Lenin, the Bolsheviks, and the Russian working class. The Russian Revolution is, for all intents and purposes, the perfect textbook case study in exactly how the masses can win a revolution. It is overflowing with exactly the kind of dialectical dynamics described by Marx and Lenin in their theoretical works. And to be honest, I do not think Lenin, the party, or the masses could have handled the situation any more expertly than they did. We start with the complete and total breakdown of the existing mode of production, a fact which necessitates a revolutionary solution. We have a proletariat class as the prerequisite for a socialist revolution. The fact that it is small but scrappy only heightens the drama. We have the complicating factor of a largely peasant agrarian economy as our stage, focusing real-time adaptation of theory into effective praxis. And we have the external factor outside of the control of any of the actors in question, the war, which keeps everyone on their toes. The class nature of the revolution could not be more obvious. First, the overthrow of the monarchy happens, which creates the opening for the bourgeoisie to step in and fill the void. These plans are challenged by the upstart masses, whom the bourgeoisie and aristocracy think are too stupid to know their place. But they are not stupid. Driven to desperation as the system collapses around them, they are class-conscious enough to refuse to know their place. Even just looking at the street level, we see in the cities factory and business owners on the one side and workers on the other, speaking openly about class warfare in speeches, at meetings, and in the press, and pursuing it through lockouts and layoffs, strikes, and slowdowns. In the countryside, the peasants refuse to be pacified by anything but the satisfaction of their demand for control over the land and its produce, free from interference by the landed gentry, and they are quick to take up arms to secure this outcome for themselves. We have as our revolutionary laboratory a practical free-for-all in which revolutionary theories and predictions of every stripe, of every tendency, and every school of thought are allowed to play out. These theories and predictions stand solely on their own merits. Whosever theory of how to win the revolution, how to seize and wield power, is correct, wins the day. In this experiment, the Mensheviks and the SRs serve as cautionary tales, warning about the dangers and pitfalls of trying to build a revolutionary movement that is divorced from the masses and is focused instead on collaboration with the ruling classes. We have the July Days as the cautionary tale against adventurism, against certain sections of the masses and the Vanguard Party running too far ahead too quickly and almost bringing the revolution to ruin. And we have the drama of the Kornilov affair, which galvanized the people of Russia and was the first test of solidarity and mutual aid. The Russian masses passed this test with flying colors, proving just how helpless the forces arrayed against them are when the masses stand shoulder to shoulder against a commonly recognized class enemy. After this smashing victory, the masses finally understand their true power and begin their march, all but unstoppable at this point, towards taking power away from those who would oppress and exploit them for profit, and putting it in the Soviets, the councils of workers, soldiers, and peasants' deputies, as an expression of popular democracy, more robust than can ever exist under bourgeois class rule. And finally, we have a masterclass in dialectical analysis. The Bolsheviks demonstrated their deep materialist understanding of the lessons of history from the French Revolution, the revolutions of 1848, the Paris Commune, and, most importantly, the lessons of its native revolutionary movements of the preceding decades, and combined this understanding with the theories that ultimately won the day in the revolutionary laboratory, of both a vanguard party of the working class and the necessity of a revolutionary proletariat state. The correctness of the Bolsheviks' analysis and theories culminated in the thoroughly impressive, precise, tactical maneuvering throughout October by the Bolsheviks, the Petrograd Soviet, and the Military Revolutionary Committee against the provisional government of the bourgeoisie. As leftists, we could not ask for anything more. Lenin, the Bolsheviks, and the Russian masses proved to the world for the first time that it is possible for the oppressed to overthrow their oppressors, for the exploited to escape from under the heel of their exploiters. They proved that it is possible, and they showed the world exactly how to do it. And for having committed the unforgivable sin of giving the masses of the world a roadmap to liberation, they were despised, isolated, invaded, and demonized. But all the slander and misinformation and misdirection in the world cannot destroy the truth of the Russian Revolution and the insights of both Karl Marx and Vladimir Lenin, that history is shaped by a combination of both forces beyond our individual control, of systems acting upon us through the generations, and the decisions we make, guided by our ability to understand those systems, how they work, and how they can be undone, and the simple fact that, when acting in unison and solidarity with each other, there is nothing that can stop us. Marxism-Leninism is often criticized for being too deterministic, almost fatalistic, about the progression of history. But this is a grave misunderstanding of historical materialism, if not an outright purposeful distortion of it. Marx's formulation of the stages of history as embodied in progressing modes of production was 90% describing history up to that point, with the final 10% being a prediction tacked on that the final stages, or at least the upcoming stages, would be socialism and communism. This was the result of detailed historical analysis over an entire lifetime. But nowhere did Marx, or for that matter, Engels, or Lenin, or Stalin, or Mao, or any other Marxist-Leninist revolutionary leader declare that history must or will proceed in these stages. In the end, Marx left us with a detailed understanding of the internal dynamics of capitalism, the conditions not of our own making, transmitted to us from the past in which we find ourselves, with its cyclical periods of accumulation and crisis. while Lenin left us with a proven blueprint for how to overcome those dynamics and break out of the cycle completely. Thanks to Marx and Lenin, we know two things for certain. As long as it exists, capitalism, no matter how all-encompassing and powerful it may appear, will eventually enter periods of crisis. And it is in these periods of crisis, such as the one in which Russia found itself in 1917, that the opening is created for the possibility of breaking out of the cycle, and that through robust materialist analysis and the fusion of the masses, even only a section of the masses, into one entity pushing with all its might, this possibility can be realized. There is no promise of success in all of this, only the promise of opportunity. It is up to us to seize that opportunity for a better world and make it a reality. So that is it. That is pretty much everything I wanted to say about the Russian Revolution. A truly fascinating period of world history, and one from which I draw nearly endless inspiration. I hope I have managed to bring some of that inspiration to you all these past 17 episodes. Before we go, I'm going to leave you all with some book recommendations. Like I have said many times already, there is always more to learn about the revolution and the Bolsheviks, and I encourage you all to do your own study. Many of these books I have read, but some I have not. I will let you know which those are, and in recommending them, I am relying on word of mouth from both personal comrades and online reviews, as well as other leftist creators I know. First are the three I used the most for my series on the revolution. There is Alexander Rabinowitz, The Bolsheviks Come to Power, Tony Cliff's All Power to the Soviets, and Leon Trotsky's History of the Russian Revolution. Rabinowitz's book is, in my opinion, the best of the three. It is extremely detailed and meticulously researched. There is a very brief prologue covering the period from February to the July days. Then Chapter 1 opens with Lenin returning to Petrograd to stop the premature uprising. And Chapter 15 ends with the close of the first session of the Second Congress of Soviets the morning of the 26th of October, with a brief epilogue about the final days of October and the first days of November. It truly is a fun roller coaster to ride, especially if you are a history nerd like me. However, there is a very noticeable limitation to his work. It is focused exclusively on Petrograd and the political machinations of the government, the Bolsheviks, and the other parties. You will find nary a mention of the peasants, only the occasional passing reference to the military situation. And other than discussing the Moscow State Conference in August, you might finish the book thinking Petrograd was the only city in the empire. As I have tried to impress on you, dear listener, the Russian Revolution was not solely about Petrograd, the Bolsheviks, and the provisional government. But if that is the story you are looking for, you will find it in The Bolsheviks Come to Power. Cliff's work, All Power to the Soviets, is actually book two of a trilogy about the Bolshevik Party, with the focus on Lenin. Book one is Building the Party, about the history of the Bolsheviks and Lenin's work prior to 1917. All Power to the Soviets is about the revolutionary period, and Book 3, Revolution Besieged, covers the post-revolutionary period through Lenin's death in 1924. All Power does a good job of covering the political and ideological battle the party and Lenin was engaged in, with the workers, the soldiers, and the peasants. It is not a chronology of events from February to October, but rather an examination of the important questions of the revolution, each in turn, and how Lenin handled them. The thing to keep in mind about this work is that, for all practical purposes, it falls into the trap of great man theory concerning Lenin. If you read it, you could well end up saying to yourself, gee, if it weren't for Lenin, none of this would have happened. I have already addressed this interpretation of the revolution, so I will only say that, if you read Cliff's work, there is a lot you can get out of it, but please be conscious of this flaw, and remember, the Russian Revolution was not Lenin imposing his brilliant ideas and iron will on the situation. Next, we come to Trotsky's History of the Russian Revolution. Leon Trotsky is, of course, one of the most controversial figures in Soviet history. Some think he was the could-have-been savior of the revolution and could have saved the Soviet Union from the backslide into Stalinist bureaucratic counter-revolution and oppression. Others think Trotsky was the counter-revolutionary, cynically donning the guise of Bolshevik in order to worm his way onto the winning side of the revolution, while later on doing everything in his power to undermine party discipline and unity as he pursued his own ideas and goals, even after they were rejected by the democratic centralism of the party. We will get to the story of Trotsky and Trotskyism soon enough, but for now, I will say this about the book. I think it is actually pretty good. It is not perfect, but over two volumes, he touches on every facet of the revolution. The workers, the aristocracy, the Tsar, the war, the soldiers, the peasantry, the land question, the military leadership, the goings-on in Petrograd, but also what was happening with the working class in Moscow, Kiev, Saratov, and other cities all across the empire. It draws on articles, memoirs, and reports from all the actors in the revolution. If you are looking for a complete socialist history of the revolution, you can do worse than Trotsky's History of the Russian Revolution in two volumes. Although I should mention, I have never seen the second volume not be split up into two parts. So if you go hunting for it, keep in mind you are probably looking actually for three books, not two. All this said, there is a giant caveat to keep in mind when reading Trotsky's history. He is, at the end of the day, not a dispassionate, objective chronicler of the events. Trotsky, like all historians, writers, and intellectuals, it must be pointed out, has an agenda. His agenda is to present the revolution as a bottom-up affair, which it was, but so that he can place it in contradistinction to the Stalinist state that arose in the 1920s, and make the argument that the Stalinist state was inherently counter-revolutionary. We will also be grappling with this narrative when the time comes. For now, I will only say that, honestly, I kind of think more people should read Trotsky's history. It really is a detailed, nearly all-encompassing chronicle of Russia in 1917. But if you read it, you need to do so with eyes wide open. It absolutely should not be your only source of information on the revolution. And we need to be skeptical of any and all claims that the Stalinist period was a period of counter-revolution, because, spoiler alert, a materialist analysis of this period reveals that it is more complicated than just Stalin bad. Rounding out the books I've read on the subject that I think are worth it, we have John Reed's classic, 10 Days That Shook the World. This work is great for a couple of reasons. John Reed was an American socialist and journalist who was in Russia for most of 1917, and his book is an eyewitness account of the days immediately preceding and following the Soviet seizure of power. Somehow, Reed winds up everywhere, among workers' meetings, at the Congress of Soviets. He even winds up in the Winter Palace on the 25th. It is a fun, relatively quick read, written with the accessibility of a newspaper article, and does a fantastic job of capturing the electric mood in Petrograd during this period. But also, the book is in the public domain, so it is easy to find just about anywhere you go for books, and cheap if you choose to buy it, although free copies are also available. Now we get into the works I have not read myself, but have had recommended to me by trusted sources, and so I am confident will be enjoyable and informative. The reason I did not read these works for this podcast is simple. I do not have the time. If I tried to read every single book written about the revolution and the Soviet Union before starting my show, given the limited time I have to work on this, I probably would not have started the show before the year 2037. So I had to draw the line somewhere, and this is where I drew it. First up, we have E.H. Carr's History of the Bolshevik Revolution, 1917 to 1923, in three volumes. I actually do have these books on my shelf, and plan to start using them and other works by Carr as sources going forward. The only reason I did not use them as sources on specifically the revolutionary period of 1917 is because across the roughly 1,400 pages of the three volumes, he discusses the period from February to October specifically for about 40 pages in total. See, Carr was not about chronicling the events of the revolution. He was about tracing the origins, development, and implementation of the systems that would come to define the Soviet Union. Absolutely fascinating stuff, and I am very excited to dive in and bring his work to you all. But in terms of the revolutionary year of 1917, 40 pages is, frankly, not worth including. Next is Walter Rodney's Russian Revolution, A View from the Third World. This is another book that is on my shelf. I just have not gotten to it yet. Walter Rodney was a Guyanese Marxist intellectual, a Pan-Africanist, and opponent of colonialism in Africa and around the world. He was assassinated by a car bomb in Guyana in 1980 after helping establish the Working People's Alliance in that country at just the age of 38. It is widely believed, although not decisively proven, that he was killed by the CIA-backed Prime Minister of Guyana. Shocking to imagine, I know. Over the course of his life, Rodney gave a series of lectures on various aspects of the Russian Revolution and the period immediately after it, through the early 1920s. He had intended to work the lectures into a full-fledged book, but sadly never got the chance. The book we did get is an edited collation of his lectures, and I am eager to read it to see what a respected, non-European Marxist had to say about the history. The final two book recommendations are Neil Faulkner's A People's History of the Russian Revolution and China Mayville's October, The Story of the Russian Revolution. These are two about which I know the least, as I have only heard about them in the online leftist zeitgeist. After reading a few reviews of them, it appears they are both well-respected works. However, both seem to fall into the Trotskyist camp of the Leninist revolution was pure Marxism-Leninism in action, and it was awesome. The Stalinist state was counter-revolutionary and bad. Boo, Stalin. You already know what I'm going to say about that. If you read these books, just keep an open mind for when we get to the Stalinist period. Okay, and with that, really, truly, we are done. For the final time, I remind you, there is always more to learn about and study and explore when it comes to the Russian Revolution, and there are always more questions to ask. But as for this show, we are now done discussing this period. I hope you have enjoyed the journey. Looking forward, I will say there will be a bit of a break before I can come back to this. I will be working on the show around the edges, but I have some seasonal work around the home that I've been neglecting, but absolutely needs to be done before the seasons change too drastically. Also, I am moving on to new sources, so that is also exciting, but I need time to read, or in some cases, reread the sources. But also, I am very excited to announce that I have been working on those interviews with former Soviet citizens I promised for the commissars on my Patreon. It has not been easy to schedule interviews with people halfway across the world, but I finally have a decent number of interviews discussing modern views on the history of specifically the Russian Revolution, and so it is time to put together those episodes for my commissars. I will let everyone know when they are available, and if you want to listen to them when they start to come out, head over to Patreon and sign up for the Commissar tier. Thank you for listening. All translations from the Russian text are provided by me, unless otherwise noted. Any errors or inaccuracies are therefore my own. If you are enjoying the show, please consider supporting me at patreon.com/sovietpod. There are tiers with different incentives, and we're also forming a really nice community over there, so go check it out. A special thank you to my commissars: Big Easy H, Cat Brannigan, Comrade Red, Dr. Fate, Hyacinth Dathenes, Jay, Jack, Josue Ponce, Rasmus Svensson, Ryan Fowler, and Sam McGeever. You guys are awesome. If you have not done so already, please leave a rating and review on your podcast service of choice and share this show with anyone you think might enjoy it. Also, feel free to reach out to me on Patreon or at sovietpod@gmail.com if you have any questions, feedback, or just want to say hi. I hope you enjoyed this episode of The Sickle and the Hammer, a socialist history of the Soviet Union. До свидания.